Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. The Ohio Supreme Court heard arguments last week over whether Toledo's only abortion clinic should stay open. The case stems from a controversial legislative change made in 2013 that mandates outpatient facilities partner with hospitals in so-called patient transfer agreements. If the clinic shuts down, Toledoans seeking abortion services would have to travel across state lines to Michigan or come to Columbus or Cleveland to find the next closest provider. We're talking about that and other state politics today in our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining me are three State House reporters, Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch. Kathy, welcome.
Good morning.
Joe Engels from Ohio Public Radio.
Great to be here.
And Jim Siegel from the Columbus Dispatch.
Good morning.
Thank you, Jim. Joe, you're outnumbered by Dispatchians today.
I know.
It's a special
morning.
Well,
you and I are public radio. I think that's a tie.
It should be a tie. That's right. All right. We'll start with the Supreme Court case, one of two that the Supreme Court's going to decide in the coming months regarding abortion and the restrictions placed on abortion clinics in recent years by the state legislature. Kathy Kandisky, in this case, what's the key issue here? What is the Supreme Court deciding?
The Supreme Court's looking to see whether some new regulations about transfer agreements that clinics have to have is unconstitutional, is an undue burden on women, and if the legislature violated the single subject rule when they passed it, which they tucked it into a budget bill.
Single subject rule is if you have a bill, it can only be for one subject.
For one purpose. And so those are the issues at hand. But the issue for folks truly is if the Supreme Court rules against this clinic, the state's going to close the clinic. That's what the state's seeking to do. And then this is, of course, the last abortion clinic in Toledo, so women in Toledo would not have abortion services. The issue is transfer agreements that the state requires clinics to have. All ambulatory surgical centers must have them. That includes abortion clinics. They have to have an agreement with a local hospital to transfer patients in case of an emergency. Abortion clinics have had a tough time getting these agreements since the state put in a new provision saying publicly funded hospitals can no longer provide them. Toledo lost its agreement about that time and had trouble getting a new one. Now they have one with a hospital in Ann Arbor. It's 52 miles away, and the state says that's too far. It's not local.
And religious hospitals, mainly Catholic hospitals, do not have these transfer agreements for
Correct.
Religious reasons. And the state argument is that because it's a state-funded hospital, it's sort of arm's-length funding of abortion if they allow these transfer agreements with abortion clinics.
That's what they argue, yeah.
Yeah. Jim Siegel, this case, there was some when Maureen O'Connor talked about the undue burden that women in Toledo might face, that raised some eyebrows perhaps that this may not be a slam dunk on a Republican Supreme Court.
Well, possibly, or she could have just been
devil's advocate.
And it's very, I have covered on and off Supreme Court cases for years, and you never want to judge what a justice is going to do based on the questions, because sometimes it really is they're just trying to make sure that perhaps she was just trying to solidify her own beliefs that against that, and that if you hear the best argument that's kind of opposite of yours, and then you still think you're right, then you can write a better decision that way. But then again, maybe she does have a belief that this is an undue burden, and that's really if the court steps up and rules on the single subject rule, that this will probably reappear quickly in the legislature as a standalone bill and will probably be moved again. The bigger concern for the anti-abortion side is that this is if they rule in the other direction on the on whether it's an undue burden, because then now you've set another standard and that's going to be much tougher to get around, and I don't think there's many who honestly argue about this. You could see this as any more than an attempt to shut down this clinic. I'm not going to have any kind of debate over whether that's proper or not, but I will say that that's clearly what is being done here. I mean, because there is no patient at any abortion clinic where if they had a medical problem could not just be taken by ambulance to the closest hospital, which would then treat that woman. It's just, so this, there's very little, I think, true value and safety issues involved here.
And the state argued, Joe, that, you know, they argued the legal merits of this, that it's the transfer agreement. It's the, you know, it was part of state governing. That's why this provision was put into the state budget. But Ohio Right to Life is pretty honest. They're trying to shut down this clinic.
Yeah, they make no bones about that. They say that abortion is killing a baby, in their opinion, and that this is a dangerous thing that they shouldn't be allowed at all, and they will push and push and push to make abortion illegal as much as possible and as fast as possible. Of course, you know, the supporters of legal abortion always point out that abortion has always been around, whether it was legal or not, and that by closing clinics, what you're doing is you're forcing more women to go to illegal abortions versus legal abortions, and of course, illegal abortions being more deadly, and there's no real data to know how many abortions are actually happening in that case.
And just one quick note on that single subject rule issue. I did find it humorous, the government's argument as to why this does not violate single subject in the Constitution, which basically the attorney said, because it involves how we operate government. And if that is really going to be the standard, then there is no such thing as a single subject rule in Ohio, and we might as well just throw it out of the Constitution.
Yeah. I mean, we have the Christmas tree bill where everything gets hung on another bill that
and
has nothing
clinics
to do with it.
The clinics in that case also argued that it was not an appropriation, so therefore it did not belong in the budget bill, was the argument on their side. But I wanted to mention that Ohio Right to Life has had a lot of success with these restrictions they've placed on abortion clinics over the years. We had 16 abortion clinics about 5 or 6 years ago. Today we have 8 of them. 4 operate without a transfer agreement. Two the state's trying to shut down, the Toledo Clinic and another one in Dayton. 2 other ones in Columbus and Cincinnati are operating with a waiver or a variance, they call it, that the health department's allowing them to operate without transfer agreements. But I think there's a lot at risk with this ruling because we could very quickly go from 8 clinics to 4.
Has there been any evidence that the number of abortions recorded by the Ohio Department of Health has gone down in that same time?
Correct.
Joe, you mentioned this hard. It's hard to track, illegal abortions. Has there been any testimony or any claims that the number of illegal abortions has increased in these areas that are no longer served by a clinic, at least have easy access to a clinic?
Well, there has been data that the number of abortions has gone up in Michigan, recently. Okay. And you've got to remember that Michigan is right across the border from Toledo. So, Toledo did have 2 abortion clinics, 1 shut down in, I believe it was 2014, and that's kind of like when the numbers in Michigan were starting to see some additional numbers there. So anyway, that could be. I don't know. Yeah. It's hard to tell.
But for women of little means and don't have the transportation, that's the argument that the undue burden falls in. Kathy, what's the end game on this? I mean, everyone's watching the U.S. Supreme Court. Right now it's 5-4. Everyone thinks as far as upholding Roe versus Wade, if Justice Ginsburg or Justice Kennedy were to retire and Donald Trump were to appoint a pro or anti-abortion justice, it might lead to the reversal of it. Where does this end? Is there an end in sight
to this? I think that's what the anti-abortion folks are waiting for, a favorable Supreme Court so they can take a case up to get Roe ultimately overturned. Until then, their strategy, as we've talked about, is kind of to chip away at abortion rights by having these restrictions placed on. They don't have a favorable court yet, but it's feasible they could very soon.
Yeah, my guess is the moment they think they have 5-4, there'll be about a 25-state race to see who gets the first case in front of them to try to overturn Roe.
And I think Ohio would be a good candidate. I think they're ready.
Herb Asher on Columbus on the Record, on WOSU TV, said that, you know, that he said that Republican lawmakers should be careful what they wish for, because if Roe versus Wade is overturned, then it goes back to the states to determine if abortion should be legal or illegal. And then, you know, pro-life legislators have to make a decision that really might be unpopular among the independents and moderates, even in their own parties. Would you agree with that, Kathy?
I totally agree. I mean, then they really have to put themselves out there on this issue. I mean, it's one thing, you know, with a lot of these restrictions, like the one we're talking about on the transfer agreements, folks can argue that this is a safety issue for women. And it sounds, you know, reasonable as a safety issue for women. But once you come down to, is, you know, are you supporting legal abortions for women or not, you really have to put yourself out there and take a stand. And, you know, it's really become kind of a litmus test on the Republican side. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you go against it and you might not win your next primary. You go for it, you know, and you lose support. I mean, it's a difficult spot for them to be in, for sure.
And a clear majority of Americans, I mean, 55% to 60% support abortion, legal abortion with restrictions. Now, that's a pretty broad statement, but that's what the I think a lot of surveys have said.
Well, Ohio mm-hmm. Right to Life Now will no longer endorse you if you support rape and incest exemptions. And so, I mean, they've gone even further over the years and because they feel like they feel empowered to do so, especially in Ohio where Republicans have been in control for so long.
Mm-hmm. Another topic kind of related, it's the flu vaccine. And there is a bill before the state legislature that would allow people to refuse a flu vaccine required by their employer. This is basically hospitals, folks who work in the clinical setting, don't want to spread the flu among patients. The lawmaker who's proposing this says this is about protecting control over our own bodies. Taking a quote from abortion rights supporters, I guess, although they would argue very vigorously, it's two different issues. But what's behind this?
Well, there's a lot of people out there who say the flu vaccine makes them sick and that they don't want to put the flu vaccine in their body because they feel like it is something that could be dangerous for them. But in the hospitals, they have a lot of patients who are very sick and cannot take the flu vaccine to, protect themselves. And if you have a worker, either a nurse or an aide or orderly, whoever, coming in with flu and maybe infecting that already frail person, that can be deadly in many cases. But, you know, the thing is that requiring the flu vaccine, when you say you're requiring someone to get a vaccine and, oh, if you don't get it, you can't have a job, that kind of rubs a lot of people the wrong way. So that's what this bill is about. You know, it's basically you cannot, and the sponsor of this bill, who is Representative Christina Rogner, or Representative Christina Hagen, sorry about that, she says that, you know, the reason that this is important is there's no data that proves that a flu vaccine actually helps. And we do know that last year, the most prominent strain of flu was not in the vaccine. So there are questions even about that.
Jim, it's kind of been a little bit watered down, I guess, as it came out of committee. And does this have a future, this bill?
It's possible. Look, the committee that this was in front of, the Federalism Committee, where it passed last week, it definitely has a number of very conservative members on it. This is kind of this committee was made for a bill like this. This is being pushed by an anti-vaccination group in Ohio, among others. And some
aren't they anti-vax groups sometimes more liberal than conservative? Or am I misreading that? Or is it a bipartisan effort, the anti-vax groups?
I don't know, to be honest. I don't really know which side of the political spectrum they come from.
Yeah,
probably come from both.
I know that like Berkeley has a lot of anti-vaccine folks saying that they, you know, that their additives in it, the MMR, and cause autism and all that kind of stuff.
You hear a lot of talk about it from moms, women, and particularly concerned about young children.
Yeah. But this came out of committee, and look, this is opposed by every major healthcare association in the state, doctors, hospitals, pediatrics, you name it. And the Chamber of Commerce is also very opposed to it because they see this as something that's infringing upon an employer's rights to run their business the way they want to. And so, this came out of committee the next day. I asked the speaker about it, Speaker Cliff Rosenberger, and he kind of gave an answer that's not typical for him. He basically said, You know, yeah, that came out of committee a little fast, and I think we're going to have to hold more hearings. So look for this bill to go back into a committee. I'm guessing probably not that one again.
Yeah.
Probably go into another committee, maybe health or something else. I'm not going to say this won't eventually make it and pass, but it's going to be a little while.
No. Kathy, you could argue. I mean, you could see why hospitals would require their employees to.
You can see why hospitals would require.
But you can see that next step where, okay, now I am a logistics company and I don't want my employees to get sick because it'll disrupt my business. Should I be allowed then to require my logistics engineer to get a flu shot so he or she doesn't miss any work?
I don't think you're going to see that happen. I mean, I know like at our office, they have somebody come in and give flu shots every year, but I can't imagine what the reaction would be if they told you you had to go get one.
Yeah.
It's reasonable in hospitals, you know, to ask for it, although I can still see, you know, it trampling a little bit on people's individual rights. I guess you could go find a job somewhere else, but I can't see this. I cannot see this spreading. It's just very problematic.
Yep. I know a lot of companies, Ohio State included, they have incentives for folks to get a flu shot. We get extra points on our health insurance, and we get, you know, basically financial incentives to get a flu shot. So,
yeah, that's a growing trend. Yeah. I mean, and just it's not just for flu shots, but general health
initiatives,
wellness programs, and such. Where, but I think the fact that this is actually injecting something into your body, not just hey, eat better and lose a few pounds. This is something that. For a lot of people, I think is kind of another step. And for some, it's just they feel like it's an arbitrary requirement. They don't think it really helps. There's some debate about that. But boy, they really the number of doctors and hospital associates who lined up opposing this really is going to make it tough for the lawmakers, I think, to pass it ultimately.
And if you think back in the Strickland days when they had the HPV vaccine and they wanted to mandate that went nowhere because of the same questions.
All right. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about Medicaid expansion. That could be back up on the State House agenda. Also, the Ohio State Fair accident. The investigation is back in the news over the weekend. Those stories, when All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're joined by a trio of State House reporters, Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch, Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio, and Jim Siegel from the Columbus Dispatch. As Bernie Sanders is pushing Medicare for all, as Congress perhaps is considering another attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act, it appears that Medicaid expansion has not completely disappeared from the Ohio State House. Of course, Governor Kasich vetoed a budget provision that would have limited his Medicaid expansion program. But, Jim Siegel, there is some talk that the lawmakers might try to override that veto.
Well, Speaker Rosenberger said back when they did the initial veto overrides, they did 11 veto overrides of Kasich budget vetoes back in early July. And at that point, the Speaker said, look, we could bring this back. And so this is not a dead issue. One of the things he said is we're going to wait and see what Washington does. Well, I think we've all so far seen what Washington has done, which is nothing. Now, in Washington, they're now trying to bring up the Obamacare repeal again. So who knows where that ultimately ends up. But basically, the Speaker said last week, he said this is one of the overrides that's still out there that we could do, and we may try to reconsider it. And in fact, they have sent out a memo asking members, you know, where do you stand on this? It's kind of a whip. You know, this is usually what the caucus whip would do, whipping votes and figuring out the count.
Counting heads, yeah.
I mean, from what I, you know, and I don't know if anything's changed, but the last time I talked to folks about this, there was a thought that, yes, they probably could get the 60 votes they need to override on this, which is a Medicaid expansion freeze that would take effect in July of 18, not letting anyone else new come on. And if you fall off, you can't come back unless you have mental health or drug issues. So, but what I was told back then was they could probably get to 60. However, there are not 60 people who want to vote for this in the Republican caucus. There, you know, this is a tough political vote, especially if it's suddenly, you know, there's the quick argument that you're throwing people off of Medicaid expansion, particularly people who are working, only not making very much money. And so it's a tough vote. And I know that there are a number of folks who would just like to see it go away as an issue. At least for now.
Yeah, the practical of this is if you say you're on Medicaid expansion now and you get a job for 6 or 9 months and then you get laid off again or your hours get cut back, you couldn't get back on after this freeze takes effect. So it could affect people right now who are enjoying the benefits of Medicaid expansion.
You may create an incentive for people not to go get a job part-time. I think last time the state looked into who's on Medicaid expansion, 43% of those on the expansion rolls worked. But like a lot of low-wage workers, they may not work all year round. They may not have full-time hours all the time. So you kind of create an incentive for them not to work if this safety net isn't there for them when they need it.
And Joe, I mean, Ohioans, especially a lot of the rural areas, they rely on this. And this is popular. Yes, it's Obamacare. It's part of Obamacare, and it's hated by many Republicans. But there are folks who are Republican who rely on this for a lot of things, not just opiate addiction and things like that, but for basic medical care.
Yeah, there are folks that rely on it, and there are hospitals that rely on this as well, because without this, some of the smaller hospitals say that they would have gone under. You know, it was, you know, vital in keeping their doors open. So that being the case, some of the hospitals are not quick to want to get rid of it either.
At on Capitol Hill, Bernie Sanders has, and I think 13 or 14 senators, Democratic senators, have joined him in pushing a Medicare for all. This is basically a complete government takeover of the healthcare system. Sherrod Brown kind of danced around a bit. He says, I support it in theory, but I don't support this bill, and I support folks who are 55 and older rather than 65, but 55 and older buying into the Medicare program. Not surprising. I mean, Ohio is a purplish state, not a true blue state. Kathy, Sherrod Brown is not jumping on the Bernie Sanders bandwagon here.
No, well, I mean, Bernie's proposal is not going to go anywhere. I mean, it's obvious. It's going to cost trillions of dollars to implement something like that. It's just not going to go. What Sherrod's proposed, and Sherrod had proposed this earlier, was to allow people 55 and over to buy into Medicare, basically to get the benefit a little earlier than they would normally. A lot easier to digest, a lot easier to propose.
A lot easier to pay for.
A lot easier to pay for. So I think he's just being practical on this one.
Plus, the other thing is that part of the sell of the 55 and over Medicare thing is that it would take a population out of Obamacare, Affordable Care Act, whatever we're calling it these days. It would take a population that costs that program a lot of money, and it would put them in another column. So it would make health care more affordable for younger people who are on the affordable health care exchanges.
Jim, do you see this as a litmus test in the 2018 election or the 2020 election for Democrats to satisfy their far-left partisans who want a single-payer Medicare government-run healthcare system, the Bernie Sanders supporters?
Well, if you're talking about the Bernie Sanders supporters, yeah, probably, because, I mean, they, you know, as we saw in this, you know, the last election, they can be pretty pretty hardcore about their stances on things. I will say I find it interesting that 14 Democrats have signed up on this on a single payer bill. I mean, that kind of shows you the shift we've seen in the healthcare debate, I think, in Washington, in that 14 are even willing to sign on to this at all. I don't think 6 years ago you would have seen 14 Democrats signing on to single payer. But there's definitely been a shift, I think, with this Obamacare debate, with the fact that more as this debate over getting rid of Obamacare has kind of educated people a little more about what it does and has actually increased its popularity. I think now we are starting to see more folks at least talking about the idea of single payer. Like Kathy said, I don't think it can be afforded right now. I don't know how you would do it, but the fact that it's even in the conversation seriously in any corners is an interesting shift. And
yeah,
and it also seems to set up the debate about, you know, there's more of a debate now on fixing the ACA, fixing Obamacare, than there is about repealing Obamacare. So maybe by having this talk about, you know, Sanders' proposal kind of shifts the debate a little bit more to the center on this issue.
There is growing support. It's still a clear minority of Americans support a single-payer approach to health care. A Pew survey in June showed that 33% of Americans support a single-payer health care system. That's up 5% just in the past 6 months. And it's up 12% since 2014. So, Joe, there is growing support, but it's still
not there.
33%. Whenever you see that 33%, that's the partisans. Yeah. That's the far, far left.
Right. And it's still not there. A lot of people, you're forgetting, a lot of people are on private insurance. And the private insurance market has worked very well for them. And if you're one of those people, you probably don't want to even consider the Medicare for 55 and over thing. It works for you. You're fine with it. Let it be. So
the key is as those premiums increase and the deductibles increase, private insurance over the years works less and less well for people, and there drives the argument that maybe something else should be done. Speaking of Democrats running in 2018, the Democrats for governor met in I wouldn't call it a spirited debate. Last week in Martin's Ferry.
I'm not sure I'd call it a debate.
That's right. It was more like a candidate's forum, honestly, it was, which was civil and it was good. You got to hear these folks who are running, Nan Whaley, Betty Sutton, Joe Schiavone, and Connie Pillich, the four declared Democrats running for governor, met for a forum sponsored by the Ohio Democratic Party in Martin's Ferry in far eastern Ohio, right on the river. Joe Engels, you watched the debate? Watched a lot of it?
Yeah, I watched it. They spent most of the time attacking Republican policies and saying – all four of them agree on a lot of solutions that they would come – how they would do it differently. So it was kind of boring because there really wasn't any sparring, if you want to call it sparring. And, it was more of an opportunity to introduce candidates because people might not know who these candidates are. So that's something that, I think that they had a chance to do, although I don't – was it televised anywhere? I don't think it was televised.
No. So, I think Dayton, actually, of all
did
places.
Did they?
Okay.
On the web, anyway. I'm not sure if it was on regular TV.
Okay, but, yeah. I watched it on online, so I didn't know if it was televised anywhere.
So what's the point of this? Is it just to try to get these folks who have limited name recognition outside of their areas to get them some recognition, get them some practice?
I think so. And I think it was interesting the part of the state they chose to have the debate in or the forum in, a part of the state that voted for Trump in the last, presidential election, and a part of the state that's hurting most economically, that the Democrats really need to make sure they win, and that's if they have any shot at the gubernatorial.
So did they focus, Joe, on economic issues for the most part in that debate?
Mostly. The big issues, economics, education. They talked about health care. They talked about the things that Democrats typically talk about.
But the argument was, Jim, that they in 2016, Democrats did not spend enough time talking about economic issues. They spent more time talking about social justice issues, gay rights issues, transgender rights issues and things like that, and got away from the bread and butter economic issues.
They did. And they talked a lot about how bad Donald Trump was as a person and the bad things he said and tweeted. And that's clearly not going to be the message that's going to win, especially out in eastern Ohio where they were for this debate. I think these are going to be forums for them to basically say, look, we have ideas that we think are better than what the Republicans are currently offering you. They're going after them for the Republicans for tax cuts that favor the wealthy, while at the same time cutting local government funds and not providing, they say not providing enough for education, not doing enough for the opioid crisis, things of that nature. I think it's probably a smart thing for them to do as a party to get these folks out there and try to, because they just don't have a lot of opportunity to hammer home a statewide message because they have such, they're so impotent at the state house in terms of power. They just don't they're so badly in the minority that they just don't get a lot of publicity for what they think. And they just frankly, they just need to come out and start offering up why they're the better alternative. And I think this is a chance to do that.
I have a solution to how they can get better publicity for these debates. If Jerry Springer were to join the race.
He might.
What is the latest on that speculation? It's getting a little late. I mean, filing deadline, I believe, is in February. So we're within the seasonal change towards that time if folks have to really get their campaigns going.
He needs to decide what he's going to do with his show and his future, actually. That's a decision he needs to make. But I'll tell you, the other one is Rich Cordray, yep. who's the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. With those two names out there as possible candidates, it's really hard. It's kind of almost like there's elephants in the room. It's really hard for the four candidates who are there, who have announced, to get out there and get in front in terms of fundraising, in terms of getting their message out, because every time, you know, the race is brought up, the other two candidates are sent as the possible saviors to take over. And the four that are there really need the name recognition. They really need fundraising. They really need those things. So if Cordray and Springer are going to jump in, that, you know, you would expect it to be sooner rather than later.
The speculative deadline for Richard Cordray, the former attorney general, was Labor Day. Now we're getting close to Columbus Day.
I mean, he's been silent. You know, it's just been all speculation on what he might do. I mean, it seems like he from my vantage, it looks like he wants to keep his job if he can.
And he's, so by far, law, prohibited from even doing any kind of politicking.
Correct. So he hasn't done it. Springer kind of threw his name out there, and you kind of wonder if he just did that to see what the reaction would be, to see what response he would get, to see whether, and then help him make a decision as to whether or not it was viable.
Yeah. I think Cordray's really got to make a decision quickly, I think. He's really running out of time. Jerry Springer could jump into this late because he's got name ID and money.
Yeah.
You can debate about whether you would take him, how seriously the Ohio voters would take him. But Richard Cordray, for as much as we know him inside statehouse circles, is not well known statewide. He hasn't been a statewide office holder for years. And, you know, I don't think too many people keep close tabs on the Consumer Protection Bureau. But so I would think if he was going to do something, that it would have to be fast at this point.
I would think this month. I mean, I really do.
Yeah, I do too.
What did you make of J.D. Vance's comments to The Atlantic, I believe, that the time was not right to run for U.S. Senate? He would have gone against Josh Mandel on the Republican side to face Sherrod Brown. Whenever I hear the time is not right, it means I probably couldn't have won.
That's exactly what it means. That's exactly what it means.
I don't know. His family, his wife just had a baby. I know there are family concerns, and he just moved here. But my guess is if he was thinking about it, he had at least done one poll.
If he thought he could win, I think he'd be in.
Yeah. Does he have a future here in Ohio in politics, do you think? He's a young guy. He's still in his 30s, I believe.
He could.
Might be 40.
Yeah, he definitely could have a future in politics. I mean, it's interesting that he wanted to go straight for the U.S. Senate. You know, it's like usually people don't go straight for that office. They, you know, get a school board, or they go for state rep even, or, you know, something before they go to U.S. Senate. So, but I could see him in a... I could see him running for an office, a lower office, and having a good shot because he's well-spoken. I don't know if anyone's ever listened to him speak.
He's all over.
He's well-spoken, and he speaks to a part of Ohio that feels they don't often get a lot of attention.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think that would bode really well in those parts of the
states. I think so, too.
I don't see him, Jim, working his way up, though, running for a state rep seat and paying his – I see him going for – governor or Senate. I honestly, he's got the name recognition, national stature. I just don't see him working his way up like say Josh Mandel did or somebody
that. Yeah, probably not. Yeah, but you know, ambition's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. That's right. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the Ohio State Fair accident investigation, the police body cameras, and the new issues they are raising, and my favorite topic, how we're going to get to Chicago in 30 minutes in a vacuum tube. When All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Our State House reporters joining us today, Jim Siegel from the Columbus Dispatch, Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio, and Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch. This is a City of Columbus issue, but it has implications statewide, and that is the use of police body cameras. Another case came up last week where there was a controversial arrest at a convenience store where a man who was wanted on some pretty serious charges of assault of a police officer resisting arrest was spotted, and police officers tried to arrest him. He resisted vigorously, and it took several officers to subdue him. The cell phone video captured an officer punching the suspect to try to get him under control, with that faced criticism. And then out came a body camera from one of the officers who was there, not necessarily the one who was actively involved in the subduing, saying that, quote, "I wish we had, that we should have choked the life out of him," or something to that effect. It was a comment likely made in jest, but the police chief took the officer off of active duty and put him on desk duty and pending an investigation. And the mayor said that was the right thing to do. And even the police union said the officer regrets what he said. But it just goes to show this is a new thing that I don't think we thought about. We thought about police body cameras showing the actions of police officers. But this caught the comments of a police officer. Should it be treated any differently?
No. I mean, well, I don't know who you ask, but from a journalist's point of view, we like getting the information.
Oh, yeah, from a public record standpoint, yeah.
Yeah. But I think that the other thing that you got to remember here is there is a segment of our population that does not trust police officers. This comment went a long way in solidifying their beliefs. And, you know, I think for all police officers, that is a big concern because, you know, most police officers are probably very good, upstanding people who don't have, you know, even this officer says he regrets the comment. Yeah. So it just makes them look bad when one of their own does this. So it kind of puts everyone on notice that, hey, you know, you've got to really think before you do. And you can't even say anything in jest because you know, you don't know how it's going to be taken.
Just so we know, the suspect in this case was African-American, and the police officers, I believe, were all white.
And I think the issue was the suspect in the case had called on folks to go out and hurt or kill or injure police officers.
Right.
So I have a little different take. I think the fact that it was what the officer said rather than what the officer did should be taken into consideration. But the reality is, and I can see how the officers were frustrated. This suspect, from their perspective, had been giving him a lot of trouble. They'd been, you know, frustrated by his actions. And then I think he was not easy to apprehend. They had to use a taser on him, et cetera. So I can understand the frustration. I can understand after the fact kind of sitting around and maybe there being some locker room talk. But the reality for these officers now is when you're wearing body camera, everything you say or do is up to public scrutiny, and they've got to get used to that fact.
Now, in Columbus, you have to turn the cameras on, Jim. Might the case like this actually have the opposite effect where, you know, officers are not going to turn it on? I mean, in other cities, they're always on. The officers don't have a choice. But in Columbus, you actually have to turn it on when you engage with a member of the public.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where you should set that standard, but it is a – you know, it's going to take some time, I think, before not only Columbus, but police departments across the country kind of figure out exactly the best way to utilize these cameras and, you know, the best policies around them. You know, there's a lot of questions about public records and body cameras and when should the video be released and to what degree. You know, there, of course, as journalists, we want as much as possible to be a public record. And frankly, that's what it should be now. But of course, you know, if they go into a house and there's children in there and their video, you know, there are circumstances where you can understand where you would not want that to be
right.
to be public. But, you know, and in terms of this case, I mean, I understand it. It's words. It wasn't actions. But at the same time, I mean, you have to, when you're empowered by the state to carry a gun and enforce the law and potentially use lethal force to do so, you have to be professional. You have to be more than professional. And a lot of officers are. But that's why these kind of things cannot go and just be brushed aside as just, you know, making joking comments on the side. I mean, you can't joke about choking people to death when you're a police officer. You know, you just, you know, and that's going to get you in trouble.
That's exactly my point.
The other thing that came out during this, in the reporting of this, is that when these videos are made public, posted on news sites and also spread via social media, that officers have been facing threats. So where is that line from a public policy standpoint, as far as releasing the records, and from a journalism standpoint, if we publish these things, if it could put an officer in danger as far as retaliation goes? That's another thing that I think that perhaps we hadn't all thought of.
Perhaps, but it feels like the horse is already out of the barn on that one, doesn't it?
Yeah.
How do you take it back now?
But, if you're not engaging in the behavior, is the threat still there? I mean, seriously, if you don't say those things, mm-hmm. are you still going to get threats? So I don't know. And as far as, the situations that Jim brought up about children and situations and stuff, I know the media is very, at least the media sitting here at this table, is very cognizant of the problems with that and tries to shield from the public things that could really damage a child or damage family relations in some way.
It's mostly a PR nightmare for them. I mean, the points that have been brought up about, I think Joe mentioned there's a segment of the population that really fears police officers, worries about what their actions, what they're going to do. So, they can't, this kind of stuff just is 10 steps backwards for them.
And the one thing to know, too, is body cameras can be used very effectively by police to prove their story and how something went down. This is not just about did the police mistreat someone. This also has been used and will be used often, I would think, to say, look, the police officer said you were resisting. You said you weren't. Look at the video. It shows you were. And the officer was very justified in the way that he handled you. And so that, I think, too, people sometimes forget this can definitely be a benefit for the police as well, as assuming they're doing their jobs the way they're supposed to be.
And we saw that to some degree in the very first case that became big with the body cameras, where a suspect was fatally shot by police. And the video showed that the person had a gun. Now, he didn't threaten the police with the gun, but he had a gun and he took it out of his waistband. And you could argue that the body camera showed the police were justified in their actions in that case. So it helped them there.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of public records, Bill Bush from the Columbus Dispatch had a terrific story in Saturday's newspaper that raised some serious questions about the Ohio State Fair accident and both the inspections before the accident and the investigation after it. If you missed the story, it basically said there is a picture that was taken moments before, just hours before the fireball ride at the state fair broke, part of the ride broke off, sending people flying into the air. One person was killed and several others were seriously injured. The picture shows what appears to be a large crack on the steel arm right where the ride broke. Inspectors from the Ohio Department of Agriculture say they did not see the crack. So that's one issue. Bill's story also reported that the State Highway Patrol released dozens of pictures when it released its investigation results, but not this one, which is arguably the smoking gun picture of all of them. What does this do to this story, Jim, do you think, right now?
Well, it just looks bad. I mean, mm-hmm. when you're the Ohio Highway Patrol and you're representing the state and you don't release the one picture that really shows that there was structural damage to this ride prior to the accident, and from what experts tell us probably existed when the inspection was done, then, that just looks really bad. I don't care your arguments about copyright and stuff. I don't see how that was a whole lot different than any of the other photos they released. And that's really – I don't know how that's really the Highway Patrol's issue. But it doesn't look good. And so this has really, I think, sparked a lot of anger among people who have watched – who have seen this. They found that – they found a bucket of paint and a wet paintbrush underneath the ride.
Yeah, there were allegations that the fair operators were painting over flaws in the machine. The prosecutors and investigators say they could not prove that or didn't find sufficient evidence that actually was occurring. But when you see a bucket of paint and a wet paintbrush, maybe they were just sprucing it up after a long ride on the road. But
well, it just raises very serious questions about Ohio's ride inspection process. I mean, if the, you know, the pit, from what the picture shows, it's just hard to imagine that this was missed. And I don't know if they're arguing that it had been painted over or something like that, but it just raises really serious issues. And if you're thinking about using, going on a ride at a fair, I think you would take this information as well and strongly reconsider. I think it's a real game changer.
Right, right.
And it goes against, Joe Engels, basically what John Kasich said, that this was almost like an act of God, that, you know, you take your chances when you go on these rides, and life is full of risks. And, you know, I'm not going to be one who's not going to go on these fun rides because of the slight risk that I might be hurt.
Well, you know, let's put it this way. Part of the fun of being on this ride would be to know that, you know, it's a dangerous thing. You know, you're up there, but you don't expect it to be dangerous. You think that when you get on the ride, you're going to come off the ride just fine, and you have that assurance, supposedly, from inspections. Well, if the inspections are not catching things, then you have to wonder, you know, really, does something need to change here? And I don't know. It surely looks bad for the state that the picture wasn't put out there, and also the whole thing with the paint and the paintbrush, that doesn't necessarily look good either. But we don't know all the facts in this case until it really comes out. So,
and the prosecutor found that there was no criminal negligence here, that nobody deliberately caused, or their lack of action caused, someone's death or someone's injury. But there still obviously will be claims of civil negligence and not doing enough civilly.
Yeah, that criminal bar it's hard to get over that bar, because proving criminal negligence almost has to show that you willfully knew that this ride was probably going to break and you know, you let it go anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't, I would, and then who do you blame at the end of the day for that? I mean, if there was a big crack and somebody painted over it, I think that might be a grounds for looking, at least taking a look at it criminally. But I don't know. I don't know that even that would be enough. But
what I'd want to know is if a worker reported it to a supervisor. You know, I'm worried about this. Take a look at this, and it was ignored or something like that.
The story in the paper mentioned that in the investigative report that somebody who had just gotten off the ride said it was shaking pretty bad, and the ride operator said, don't worry about it, basically, and get on, or I'm going to give your seat to somebody else. And I mean, the narrative was before the story was that this was a crack that couldn't be seen. It was sort of on the inside of the metal, that nobody could have seen this. It was, unless you had like an X-ray or something like that. Well, this story and this photograph changes that narrative 180 degrees.
Oh, completely. Because, yeah. I mean, and let there be no doubt, where the crack is located is almost identically where the crack
where it
broke. Because if you look at the arm after the break, it's in the exact same spot. And it even follows the line of where that crack goes.
Yeah. The tragedy of it all is that it could have been prevented. You know, if it was visible like that, like the picture showing now how visible it was, it could have been prevented. They could have closed the ride down.
Yeah. Well, more to come on that. Finally, the Hyperloop. This is the story that many in Columbus are very excited about. This is new technology. Columbus is a finalist, I believe, one of 11 areas around the world for this new futuristic transportation system where you take a vacuum tube, you have a small car and a vacuum tube. It's a larger vacuum tube, obviously, not the ones at the bank tellers. And it will bring you from Pittsburgh to Columbus to Chicago. It's fast. You can get to Chicago on this Hyperloop, they say, in 29 minutes, not 30 minutes, not 28 minutes, but 29 minutes. City officials of Morpsey applied for this. They're finalists. We don't know how much it's going to cost. We don't know when it's going to be open. We don't know if it's proven, but we're on board. At least Morpsey is.
Well, Back to the Future, the movie, said we were supposed to have flying cars as of last year. So this is at least
they're behind. You know,
at least we're already behind. But no, I will say at least we have some folks looking at actual next generation transportation. Mm-hmm. You know, between this and the self-driving cars. I mean, it's about time that we finally get around to, you know, deciding, hey, you know, we could, you know, this is 2017. There's got to be a better way to move people around rather than just everyone sitting in their cars and trying to merge into traffic on 71, 670, and et cetera. So I'm at least happy to see us a real vision of ways to quickly move people around and in a way that that isn't just let's just widen another road.
But it's sparking light rail discussion again, which I think that's something that.
But is it though? Or are we moving past?
Well, no, I'm seeing.
I mean, Alex Fisher from the partnership said we shouldn't worry about 19th century technology anymore. Well, the heck with trains.
Yeah, but then if you look at the comments under any Hyperloop story, it immediately goes to, you know, we need fast rail transportation in Columbus. So, you know, the fact that this would provide a route to Chicago in less time than it takes a resident of Delaware County to get to downtown Columbus. I mean, that does have people.
This sounds like a personal issue here for Joe, doesn't it?
you mentioned, Kathy, you want to Hyperloop yourself, right?
I want to Hyperloop myself. I just think it's exciting that they're talking about it. I don't know if I want to see what it'll cost.
Yeah.
And I'm interested to see what this will cost compared to what light rail will cost.
And how many tax dollars go to. Towards this literal pipe dream.
And
it's
does
a literal
it hurt?
Pipe dream.
What gets built first, this or the wall?
Thanks to Jim Siegel, Joe Engels, Kathy Kandisky, our Statehouse panel. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann on 89.7 NPR News.